Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, folks, so we came in here and Anne and I and the rest of the team came in this building on the 1st of July 1989, and we had a formal opening on the 23rd of August 1989, which all of you here will remember was the 50th anniversary of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which we thought was important, but no one knew what it was. I certainly thought it was important, yeah. And although all my lefty mates always said it never happened, but anyway. So we started here on the 23rd of August 1989 with an opening with the then Premier Bob Carr, the then Premier Nick Greiner and the opposition leader Bob Carr. And that was held upstairs, and we have a lovely photograph of the Premier and the opposition leader and our then chairman, and it's photoshopped, it's gatecrashed by Patrick McGuinness, of all people, which is hardly surprising. Where we're going is this building is going to be refurbished, not demolished, but substantially refurbished out the back, and our landlord, Dexys, has offered us very good accommodation in Governor Phillip Tower, level 40 Governor Phillip Tower. So we go in there on Monday, we move here at the weekend, and everything will proceed much the same. And yes, there'll be drinks. As to events that have happened here, so many events that have happened here, but before I call on Patrick Morgan, I think the most memorable one was when Anne and I, because it's a pretty lonely building here by yourself, it's five levels and not many staff here, and the other staff have gone home and the doorbell rings and there's this person down the end saying, "Let me in." And I took it upstairs on one of the phones upstairs, which the intercom upstairs, and said, "Well, who's there?" He said, just let me in, will you?" And I said, "Well, who's there?" And he said, "For God's sake, will you just let me in? I just want to get in." And I said, "Oh, Christ." I said, "Well, who is he?" "Okay." And I said, "Okay, look, I'll press the button, and then I'm coming down the stairs on level two, and this guy's walking across the floor. I can hear the noise, and he yells out, "Oh, it's Paul Keating here." And I said, "Oh, Paul," I said, "I thought it was some kind of nutter." And he said, "Jared, it is some kind of nutter." And then he came up to talk about something I'd written about another matter, and then he spoke about something I'd written about John Howard, and then I thought it was going to end, and then he said, "But as for that bastard Hawkey," he said. So then we went on for another half an hour. So a lot of things have happened here, but you're not here for that tonight. You're just here for the food and the drink. Oh, and of course Patrick Morgan. So I'll introduce Patrick. He's an old friend of Anne, and well, he's not an old friend, he's just a friend of Anne and Patrick Morgan, a long-time friends of Anne and Gerard Henderson, going back to Melbourne University in another century, but I'm not saying which one. And Patrick is making a welcome return to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, The Vandemonian Trail, Convicts and Bushrangers in Early Victoria. And Patrick is the author of a number of books on Gippsland, where he's lived for some decades, but also an excellent two-volume edited edition of Bob Santa Maria's correspondence and papers, which came out some years ago now, about 8 or 9 years ago now, which was an excellent publication. He's also the he co-edited the academic edition of Henry Kingsley's The Recollections of Geoffrey Hamlin, and also was associate editor of the Oxford Literary Guide to Australia. And tonight Patrick Morgan's going to talk for us on the topic, why the 19th century in Victoria was different from New South Wales and Tasmania. Patrick, you're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm going to talk as a Victorian or a Melburnian, so I should mention Gerard and I have a long history at the university in the early 1960s. I was vice president of the Melbourne ALP Club, and Gerard was president of the DLP Club. He's not quite sure which is a higher position. But I think to be vice president of ALP Club was slightly more prestigious than that. By the way, both of us have completely relinquished those connections and don't want them mentioned anymore, that we had those positions. Before I speak, I'd just like to say, on the parochial theme of Melbourne, that Gerard and Anne got started in Sydney, this institute, which has been a wonderful organisation. It brings, in a parochial way, a Melbourne sharpness and toughness. Melbourne politics is pretty rough, and people fight in gangs, and Gerard has brought, which is good, a certain Melbourne sharp edge to politics, or I'd say really public life in Sydney. So I think that's a great thing he's done to bring this, and he's lifted the level of discussion of public issues for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. And he also has the courage, which is very difficult these days when you've got legions of people who have politically correct or trendy views, to actually speak against the tide, as he does on the program called
Insiders.
This is how tight Melbourne is. Our son happens to be the associate producer of Insiders. And there's a wonderful incident, and this is connected with the group Think of the AL of the ABC.
Sorry, can you talk into the microphone?
Yes, sorry. In the Insiders, the ABC program on Sunday morning in politics, they have a green room where people sit around and chat for half an hour before the show. And my son walked into the room at 8:30, and there was David Marr and all of them chatting together, and poor Gerard sort of slightly out of things because they have very different views. And then, to break the slightly embarrassing silence, Gerard walked over to my son and said, "Oh, Danny, haven't seen your parents for a long while," and started to talk to them. And all the others pricked up their ears, and my son said, "I could see my ABC career completely disappearing." Because my family was connected with Gerard Henderson, which was a kiss of death. So on this last night of the proms for the Institute, I'm very pleased to acknowledge the contribution that Gerard and Anne have made to Sydney life. Now, I start off with a theme called Clean Skin Victoria, and how Victorians look at life, which is rather different from other states in Australia. The Sydney journalist Alan Reid reported federal politics at Parliament House for many decades. But when a federal budget came out, he always said he couldn't help himself. He first looked at how his own state, New South Wales, had come out of the budget. In this talk, I'm likewise thinking as a Victorian first. I recently published a book called The Vandemonian Trail on how gangs of rough Tasmanian ex-convicts and bushrangers came across Australia and terrified the living daylights out of us Victorians during the gold rush. In working on this theme, why they, of course, terrified the living daylights out of us is we were not a convict state. They can't hear at the back.
You've got to talk into the microphone.
Yeah, but not too close.
Not too close.
The Tasmanian convicts came across to Victoria and terrified the living daylights out of clean skin Victorians. In writing this book, I came to realise how different the founding of our state, Victoria, was from New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land. But in the second half of the talk, I'm going to show the opposite, really, how the experiences Victoria had were turned by our early novelists, all of whom, the main ones, lived in Victoria, into a self-image for the whole of colonial Australia. Victoria was established as a convict-free colony, uncomfortably wedged between two surrounding, originally convict colonies of New South Wales and Tasmania. So our social profile was very different. But the gap was even greater because Victoria was founded in the 15 years we had between being founded in 1835 and gold coming in 1851. In this 15 or 16 years period, we were founded by a group. There were no free selectors. They all became squatters. We didn't have really a free selection period then. There were only a few thousand people. A group who were called themselves Port Phillip Gentlemen. They immediately founded the Melbourne Club. They were people of lower aristocracy and high gentry background. We were founded 50 years after New South Wales, at the time when army officers who'd been decommissioned after the Napoleonic Wars were coming, and when land enclosures and industrialisation were driving the rural gentry of England, who wanted to continue living the free, untrammelled life of grazing on broadacres, to seek out the golden lands of Australian Felix in order to keep living in their accustomed style. From the start, the Port Phillip gentlemen, who founded the Melbourne Club, had pretensions to high status. Victorians, therefore, were poles apart from the convict desperados to their north and south. So from early Victoria, Victorians considered themselves superior, both socially and because later of their enormous riches from gold from other states. You are the premier state, and we reluctantly acknowledge that. But privately, Victorians consider ourselves, for these reasons, the leading state, and perhaps still do today. Of course, similar events to the ones I'm going to describe happened in other colonies, but this extreme contrast between high quasi-aristocratic aspirations, which I'll give examples of, fighting off low convict and criminal ruffians, made early Victoria unique. I now move on to movement across the state. By the way, I have maps here. Where's my notes? Have you got them out? I should give out because this talk just...
Don't give them out now.
No, all right, I won't. I'll give them out later, but I can just explain them. Victoria was founded by a pincer movement of overstraighters from... Victoria was founded by a pincer movement... They can't hear me.
Patrick, the mic... Oh, hang on, someone turned it off. Hang on, it's not working. It was working.
It's working.
Okay. The mic is working. Okay, so you just got to talk into it without popping. Can we just... Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. All right. Everyone should be quiet. Okay.
Victoria was founded... indicate if you can't hear me, as you have been. Victoria was founded by a pincer movement of overstraighters from Van Diemen's Land, the majority group, and overlanders from New South Wales, the minority group. Both groups contained a number of former convicts. Even before Victoria was settled by Europeans in 1835, convict escapees from Van Diemen's Land were making their way across Bass Strait. After Melbourne was founded, former convicts and other desperados escaped in whole groups across Bass Strait into Victoria, causing mayhem and murder on the mainland around Melbourne. With the discovery of gold, the overstraight traffic increased immeasurably, with a quarter of the Tasmanian, the VDL population, many with convict origins, coming across to the Victorian gold fields, which is what my book's about. We had no gold, we had gold and no convicts, and Tasmania had convicts and no gold, so the transfer was inevitable. The governor of Tasmania, Denison, reluctantly, because he was asked by his parliament or his advisers, reluctantly offered a reward of £500 for finding gold in Tasmania, and then remarked in a high tone that his state was so fortunate as not to find any, since he feared gold rushes would bring anarchy in their train, and he had enough problems in social cohesion with the convicts already. The first major Australian novelist, Henry Kingsley, arrived in Melbourne in 1853 during the gold rushes, the start of them, and the first thing he noticed was that the locals were terrified that a gang of Vandemonians, there's Van Diemen's Land, but Victorians call them Vandemonians, with the emphasis on demon. That caused 2 years later VDL to change its name to Tasmania. He noticed that Victorians were terrified that VDL convicts would come over in large numbers and terrorise their respectable colony, as the Mike Howe gang had done in Tasmania. Victorians thought they could distinguish Tasmanians by their physiognomy. The magistrate in Bendigo, called Bendigo Mac, said he could see criminality stamped on their faces. And when two convicts who murdered people in Melbourne were hanged or hung, the local doctors were called in and they examined their skulls and they said their cranial capacity was much larger than ordinary people, implying that Tasmanian convicts had DNA which inevitably caused them to have criminal propensities. The new Victorian government, founded in 1854, virtually the first bill they passed in their first session was a Convict Protection Act. Well, time's revengers, this is what Australia's doing now. I'm not against that, but very similar today, a Border Protection Act, that any person who was a ticket of leave man, even though he was exonerated from being a convict, would not be allowed in Australia. And amazingly, the British Parliament overrode this act on the quite decent grounds that any member of the British Empire at that stage, had free movement throughout the empire. So the Victorians sort of didn't get away with getting rid of the Tasmanians who came across. There were three stages in these outrages which traumatised Victoria and, of course, led to the Kelly case, which is the third one. Kelly's father was a Tasmanian ex-convict. The first convict outrages occurred around Melbourne, as I've said, in the 1850s. The rough quasi-criminal gang, the VDL contingent, soon moved north, some to Ballarat and Bendigo, but my book is on the group, Tasmania sits under Gippsland, a very large group moved through Port Albert, central Gippsland, to the Omeo gold rushes, quite big rushes in the 1850s. My book's based on a discovery that the two main folklore figures of 19th century Australia, the Tichborne Claimant and Bogong Jack, both worked in the same butcher shop in Hobart, amazingly. Bogong Jack, there are many, I'll talk about him later, but there are many legends of Bogong means mountains, and in the Victorian mountains, any bush ranger whose name started with John or Jack was called Bogong Jack, so quite a number of them, but there are two famous ones, and I'll describe their activities in a moment. The Tichborne Claimant, you may have known of. It's the biggest legal case in 19th century history, the longest trials in that stage in English legal history. In 1866, in Wagga, a man calling himself Tom Castro, everyone had fake names in these times, said he was the heir to the Tichborne estates and titles. He sued the Tichborne family when he went back to England. And it's a bit like the Lindy Chamberlain case. For 10 years, Australia and England, there were two sides. He looked plausible, but he didn't look plausible. Lindy Chamberlain has just died, sadly. A lot of people said she was not guilty. Other people, and she was first of all got off then.
I think it's her husband who died.
Husband who died, sorry.
Ex-husband.
The feeling was an enormous interest in this case from both sides, and no one could quite work out whether this was true or not. The English novelist Trollope happened to be in Australia at the time, and he said, Australians didn't really believe the Tichborne claimant's story, but they enjoyed the way he could beat the English at their own game. that was basically it. So these two figures both worked together as butchers in Hobart, On the goldfield, butcher in inverted commas means a person who knocks off cattle, strips them off in a gully because there's no hides left, and then sells them on the goldfields as meat. Both the Tichborne claimant and Bogong Jack were involved in this activity, as well as other things. They became legendary figures in Australian folklore because stealing gold, Bogong Jack, or an English title and estate, the Tichborne claimant, were shortcuts to making a fortune here. In addition, there's another movement down from New South Wales because coming down through Goulburn and Canberra and the Monero, people, of course, are moving down for 50 years, and on the Monero, the overseers, not the squatters, tended to be ex-convicts. And when Victoria was now founded, these ex-convicts left the squatters in Monero and they formed the main squatting properties in Omeo and around Wangaratta and the Ovens Valley in northeastern Victoria. In the Ovens Valley, the founding squatter there is an Irish convict who's up to his neck, and his sons are and his grandsons are in bushranging. The Crisp family and the Parslow family of Crabungra and around Beechperth, the big squatters there are all convicts who engage in Victoria in bushranging activities. In Omeo, many of the Omeo squatters are ex-convicts, but they don't themselves involve themselves in bushranging in Victoria. I'll just mention the oldest family in Victoria. We're much younger than you. This wouldn't knock a feather off you, but the oldest family now in Victoria on their property is the Pendergast of Omeo. They were convicts who came out from Ireland, and when they got to New South Wales, they were involved in the 1810s and 20s in rackets connected with the Rum Corps in fake contracts to the army, and they had multiple convictions in Australia as well as England. Now they are up in Benambra, and they were very embarrassed when some historian found this out about 20 years ago. It's not clear whether the family knew it before that. So these squatters in northern Victoria were also bush rangers, and there's once again a pincer movement. Omeo was formed by Tasmanian crims coming up from the south to Omeo Field, and a number of convict squatters to the north of them too. These groups were involved in four types of criminal activity. The first type is stealing horses and cattle. They simply pinched cattle and horses on the Gippsland Plains, rebranded them in the mountains around Omeo, and then sold them off in northern Victoria. And on the return journey, they did the same thing. They did it right up to the Riverina, picked up horses and cattle, rebranded them and sold them back. That's their first activity. Their second activity, as I've mentioned before, is cutting up stolen cattle for meat on the goldfields. Thirdly, they moved into murder, bumping off their opponents and occasionally people of their own gang who they'd fallen out with. And fourthly, holding up gold consignments. So they're involved in these four activities. This is quite common. This combination, of course, is common throughout Australia. So the second major outbreak of bushranging mayhem, including multiple murders, led by Bogong Jacks Associated, occurred around Omeo in the 1850s, and this caused an enormous fuss in Melbourne, because Melbourne people thought themselves respectable, and they'd learnt in the 1850s there may be a great convict outrage in Victoria, and it happened in 1859. The police then chased them over the mountains into northern Victoria, around Beechworth and up to the Monero. And then the last outbreak was the Kelly Gang in the 1880s. The Kelly Gang was connected with the father was an ex-Tasmanian convict, and his sons and relatives and were formed interconnected groups then. The Australian public saw the Kelly Gang as something new, something happening out of the blue. That's how we see it. But in fact, Victorians at the time saw it as the last hurrah of the Tasmanian desperadoes. Now, why this became important was that the three main early novelists of Australia immortalised these events and these people, particularly Bogong Jack, who's a sort of Robin Hood figure. In the stories on Bogong Jack, he's the guy who smartly beats the policemen, so they all love him. He looks after other people. In fact, himself was a criminal who was charged with accessory to murder. He's just really a very low-grade thug. But he got this romantic notion, like Captain Starlight in Robbery Under Arms, of the romantic. And he was a tall, the police descriptions show he's a tall, handsome, dark-haired man. Many of the convicts themselves were actually small, runty convicts, very unprepossessing people, if I could say that. And so he became a romantic hero. These themes were taken up by the three major novelists of early Australia, Henry Kingsley, Marcus Clarke and Rolf Boldrewood, who all themselves came to Victoria as part of the gentry group. Two of those novelists had quasi-aristocratic or gentry background, and Kingsley, of course, was the brother of Henry Kingsley, was the brother of Charles Kingsley, wrote novels, invented muscular Christianity, and at this stage he's the chaplain to Queen Victoria. So this is fairly high up in the pecking order. All wrote on the same topic, the great misty cloud of folklore that grew around the Tichborne, Bogong Jack and other legends. These stories were all about Tasmanian and New South Wales convict bushrangers wreaking havoc wherever they went. Kingsley himself was in Omeo when these outrages occurred, so the first major novel in Australia, The Recollections of Geoffrey Hamlin, is an actual description of these events. We know that Marcus Clarke wrote The Term of His Natural Life, which is the book which established in the public mind the horrors of cannibalism and the awfulness of the Tasmanian convict system and what they could get up to. And Rolf Boldrewood's novel, after the famous one, Robbery Under Arms, which has similar themes, Nevermore, is based on the Omeo goldfield and amalgamates the Tichborne, Bogong, Jack and Nat Kelly conflicts. These three novelists had a lot in common. They settled in convict-free gentlemanly Victoria. One of them was a member of the Melbourne Club. They lived in that society. They wrote on the same stories, and they set their fictions not in Victoria, but they set them in New South Wales and Tasmania, because Victorians prided themselves, which is true, we never produced a bushranger, they all came from other states, which actually happened too. And the novelists, as imaginative novelists, were fascinated with the convict bushranger fraternity, which was totally opposite in social terms to their own group. Boldrewood was a member of the Melbourne Club, and one of the earliest members, a revered member of the Melbourne Club. All three novelists had distinguished gentry status backgrounds themselves, out of which they feared they were dropping in Australia. They all hoped they might prosper in Australia. This is the fate of everyone. Everyone at this stage was in the situation. But they also feared they might relinquish their gentry status here. So their fictions are not just a detached observer accounts of what other people are doing. Their fictions are displaced musings of their own very real status anxieties in Australia and their own possible predictions taken to imagined extremes of wealth and failure. I'll now talk on fluid identities. Their experience, of novelists and people, worrying about failure or success in a new fluid society was the lot of immigrants in a new country. The novels and folklore reflected reality, and they described very rapid swings, for better or worse, in one's wealth and social status, as you'd expect after gold was found in prodigious quantities. So rapid were the social shifts that you often find in these books characters who have fluid identities. They shift from one extreme to the other. Gentlemen bushrangers, the aristocrat down on his luck, the ex-convict squatter, the lost heir. I'll just give two examples of this phenomenon, which is common in Australian life at this time, like the Tichborne claimant claiming he's a lord, and he's just a low-grade Tassie butcher. Rolf Boldrewood himself. People said, his name's not Rolf Boldrewood, that's just an alias. He's Tom Brown, Thomas Brown. Thomas Brown was the alias. Thomas Brown was the illegitimate grandson of an Irishman called O'Flaherty from Galway. The family hid this background, and of course when you came to Australia, no one knew your background in England. So when the family got to Australia, they said that they were from a family called Brown, who were the leading gentry family, Protestant family, in the west of Ireland. So the Boldrewood family faked their identity in very much the same way as the Tichborne claimant did. This was a real-life story just as fanciful as anything Boldrewood wrote in his novels. Just imagine if Boldrewood had rolled up to the Infant Melbourne Club in 1835 saying he was an illegitimate Irish O'Flaherty. It's very unlikely he would have got in. By 1900, when the Melbourne Club celebrated its 60th anniversary, he was the most famous and revered member. Who was Captain Standish, Chief Commissioner of Victorian Police? You've probably got similar stories in New South Wales.
Yeah.
I'm going to give his history, but this happens in Australia. He was the Chief Commissioner during the Kelly Hunt. From a minor aristocratic background, he led a dissolute life in England, gambling his money away, and he had to flee England and ended up in Tasmania to dodge his gambling debts in England. No new story. This happened to a lot of people. He moved to Victoria when gold came out, and on the gold fields, he was convicted of sly grogging. This is the police commissioner. 3 years later, he's police commissioner. In 53, he's convicted of sly grogging on the Victorian goldfields. He turns up in Melbourne, and he fakes his career. He says, "I'm Captain Frederick Standish, who got his commission at Sandhurst." Well, people in Victoria said this was a Bass Strait commission. When he was in Tassie, he was nothing. He gave himself a commission as he got to Victoria. He joined the Melbourne Club, and within 3 years, because they had the establishment there, said, "We'll make you Chief Commissioner of Police, no questions asked," and he was Chief Commissioner of Police. By the way, quite a good one, from 1858 till 1880, but he was a bit past it at the time of the Kelly Gang and mishandled that. These are just examples of the fluidity of society at the time. There is another fact which comes out in these books in an Australian society, which is we talk about downward social mobility, but the big problem these people had was not dropping down the class scale, but was dropping from a status society to a class one. Of course, in England, as we know from late medieval times, England was divided into very rigid aristocrats, gentry and commons. Once a gentleman, always a gentleman. This was a fairly rigid system based on birth, inheritance, land and money. Australia was founded just as this type of society based on rank or status was being replaced in England by a class one, the one we're familiar with, based on employment and earned wealth, which allowed movement between the ranks. The great horror of these novelists and people in Australia was dropping out of the class system, out of the status system, into the class one. There was a group of people called distressed gentlewomen. Or even in the 1930s, George Orwell's family was a family that had worked in India. When they came back, they had their pension was almost nil. They were keeping up appearances of being middle class, but they didn't have a brass razoo coming from India. The attraction of the Tichborne case was that an ordinary Australian working man could end up not just wealthy, many did that, but as a lord with an Australian seat. So it was to keep up status was the great thing. To be a gentleman, to be respectable was the great thing. Australian squatters could sit on their verandas enjoying life in a way that the landed classes in England could not because of these social changes I mentioned before. So Australian squatters could bypass the changes occurring in England. And a very impressive book has been written on this theme, Arcady in Australia by Coral Lansbury. This is a trivia question. Who's Coral Lansbury? Malcolm Turnbull's mother. A very good book. Of course, many other states had similar experiences. I want to show now how the experience described by these three novelists became the template by which Australians viewed themselves in the 19th century, and it's the template we get, for instance, in the Mary Grant Bruce stories a bit later. The basic structure of these events and the novels and folklore which arise from them is revealed if I recite the four main myths of early Victoria, one every decade. In 1830s, Victoria's just found, a convict appears out of the bush. He's been William Buckley, convict at Sorrento in 1803, ran away, lived with Aboriginal tribes for 30 years, and then reappears to join European society in 1836. In the next decade, 1840s, a distressed white woman has been seen with an Aboriginal tribe in eastern Victoria who've presumed to take her captive. It was thought she was a survivor of a shipwreck boat in Bass Strait. Rescue parties are sent out to retrieve her. Melbourne society is horrified that a white woman is living with Aboriginal tribes. Aboriginal tribes were harassed to produce her, but the supposed white woman was never found. In the next decade, another Bogong Jack, not the Tobart one, but a Wangaratta Bogong Jack, a respectable farmer from the Ovens Valley, who's involved in bushranging and pinching cattle. She's chased by the police into the Australian Alps, lives with an Aboriginal tribe near Omeo for a number of years, and then resettles back into his former life after he's pardoned. In the next decade, the 1860s, an English butcher, Arthur Orton, I've mentioned this, sunk to the lowest rungs in Australian society before he returns in style in England to claim the Tichborne baronetcy. Merely to recount these events is to reveal a similar patterning in their structure. This is how people think in mythic terms. In each case, an individual leaves England for Australia, the first step in a succession of exiles and social descents. Then he or she moves away from the capital to the bush, another descent in Australia into the strange and unknown bush, another move away from civilization, then a further and last descent, because in all these cases they are living with low-life criminals or nomadic Aboriginal tribes, the very lowest to the Victorian mind rung of existence. Then in all cases comes the reverse movement, except the poor white woman, towards resurrection, as the central figure slowly mounts the steps back to normality by leaving his low country, by emerging from the bush, by joining metropolitan society, and then usually returning to England, even aspiring to go the whole hog and become an aristocrat, as the lowest of all these, Arthur Orton, the Tichborne claimant, does. The descent of the hero into the wilderness or the underworld, where he undergoes trials and challenges which have to be overcome before returning to the upper world, is a common mythic archetype. 19th century pub talk seized on these stories, the papers are just full of it for 40 years, which could be readily shaped in our own wish fulfillment imagination into these familiar outlines. And the template these stories established through the novelists and through the folklore was that the colonial Australians didn't see themselves as having an Australian existence in its own right, an independent existence as we have now. They saw themselves as having experience dependent on and closely relating to England, which they called home, a very important word. Our English past and our Australian present were to be merged together into the same experience. They saw it as the same experience. Australians at this stage didn't see Australia, as later mateship nationalism did, as opposite to England. Life here was just part of a larger adventure, the British way of life. Mary Grant Bruce has this view. And we could succeed if we used our temporary Australian sojourn to improve our lot here so that we could return better than when we left. Australia, therefore, was a roundabout way of improving our British status. And, of course, that's the theme of one of Dickens's great novels, Great Expectations, where the convict comes back. Of course, for those who didn't go back, the ideal was that we could be slightly superior. The Australian type was a slightly superior version of the English type. Not mateship at all, but the novels of Henry Handel Richardson, Rolf Boldewood and Mary Grant Bruce have this view. They loved England, but they thought, we're not as fussy as the English, we're not as aristocratic, etc. We are a slightly improved type, and of course that was the idea that the Anzacs had in the First World War. On the other hand, of course, Australia could be a place where you reverted to barbarian and low behaviour. This British-Australian amalgam, which I've described, created by the novelist and folklore, was the great self-ideal and self-image of 19th century Australia. Just as in the 20th century the great ideal was mateship nationalism, and in the 21st century multiculturalism, I'm not saying I agree with all these things. I'm just saying that is the self-image of the country at the time. The Kelly outbreak is crucial because it's the tipping point where the earliest status idea based on respectability, being a gentleman and having British value is transformed into the mateship one. You see, the Kelly one is part of the earlier status thing, all these things I've been talking about, but the Kellys transform it into a one of class and of class antagonism. That's a new move. And in addition, the Kellys add Catholic and Irish elements, which introduced further divisions. So it becomes a class squabble, a religious squabble, and a fight between England and Australia. If you're Australian, you're not English, etc., etc. Mateship discounted England. I mean, the phrase, the Poms, is the giveaway. If you refer to the Poms, you say, I'm an Australian, you deride the Poms. Mm-hmm. Mateship discounted England, putting Australia and England in opposition to each other. This fact, the dominance of the mateship myth, has obscured the earlier narrative recounted in this talk, which was the organising principle for the most widespread version explaining life in colonial Australia. Thank you.
Many thanks, Patrick. And so we come to questions and discussion. So we come to questions and discussion. Is that around? I think the microphone could be better, actually. I think it could be a bit better. Could you just... The microphone, could you... I know. Okay. I just said I think it could be better. Whilst we're doing that... I've got... Janet Grundy's got a copy of the Vandemonian Trail, Convicts and Bushrangers in Early Victoria, which has just been released, and I'm sure Patrick would be happy to sign a copy of that tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. Our last period of this at the Sydney Institute. Can I start off, Patrick? You mentioned the movement of Tasmanian convicts from Tasmania to Victoria, particularly to Queensland. But
Victoria to not Queensland.
From Tasmania, sorry, to Victoria, and particularly to Gippsland. But as I recall, when I lived in Launceston some decades ago, there was also a feeling in Launceston that Launceston had helped found Melbourne, that was it Faulkner, had influenced Batman, and that in a sense, if it wasn't for Launceston, the Melbourne Club never would have been created. So there's the convicts going over to rob everyone, and there's Batman going over to buy the land from the Aborigines. So how do those two mythologies fit in?
Well, they're what are called the overstraters. Of course, Victoria was founded totally by Tasmanians. Virtually Tasmanians founded Victoria, and they're the overstraters. The first group is the group you mentioned. Some of those people, I think, either Faulkner or Batman is a convict, is that right?
Okay.
I'm not sure. Anyway, they are the group, and they're not wealthy people at all. They found Victoria, but as soon as they find Victoria, this other group, the very wealthy aristocratic people, move in. So you've got the Backman Faulkner group, the original ones, the aristocratic group, and at the same time, convicts are coming in. So it's a fairly explosive social mix. The Victoria is basically founded from Tasmania, not from New South Wales.
So, question, yeah.
Paddy, one of the interesting features of some of the cases you discuss in the book, it's the way in which so many people were able to hide their old identity by changing their name in such a faraway place as Australia. And this then led to a lot of claims on disputed will estates and whatever. Can you tell us a bit more about that as a feature of that time in Australia?
There's a question about...
It led to a lot of stories being told in novels and whatever. It wouldn't happen today.
There's a question about the changing of names to disguise identity. Yes. Come back in.
It's a form of breaking the law.
Well, it applied not only to human beings, it applied to horses, because these guys just simply changed the brand. Bogong Jack had a brand which was, it was a sort of BJ, it was very similar to the main squatter up at Omeo, and he just had to put a bit of chalk on and brand it a bit, and he could change the identity of horses. And the police went crazy because you're supposed to have paper saying what the horse was and who it had been bought off. So it wasn't just changing names of people, horses had fake identities, and also people had not only their surname but their nickname. So the publican at Sale said, you know, there was Greenhide Jack, and he lists all these people in the pub. And, of course, no one has any idea who these people are. And like the Tichborne claimant, he started off as Arthur Orton. And then when the police chased him because he had horse-dealing convictions, in New South Wales he turns up as Thomas Castro. And then he wants to turn up as the Tichborne claimant. So this was a very... This was a very common feature because there were no electoral records. There were very few baptismal records. In the part of I come from Gippsland, a Anglican clergyman came down about 5 years later and started baptising babies who'd been born, you know, in the first 5 years that white people have been there. But there were no government records of your birth. And there were no government records of marriages in Gippsland at the time. I mean, it's gradually fixed up. So there were no passports. You didn't have passports in the way that we have it. And people were moving from state to state. I mean, it still happens. My daughter, for her troubles, was in the National Registration Board. And every time a naughty doctor misbehaved and was knocked out by the Victorian registration, he'd turn up in Western Australia. They've now stopped that. But you understand, it hasn't entirely disappeared, really. So that was very common at that stage, and it makes it very, and it's also a fascination of this story about just who these people are. To the extent of the phrase Bogong Jack, to give an example of him, the original Bogong Jack is a man in Wangaratta. There's a documented trial of him, he gets 7 years. And in the paper he's called Bogong Jack, Jack Andrews, who's stolen cattle, disappeared for a number of years with the Aborigines I've mentioned, and he's a documented case. Then you get the guy from Tasmania, and he arrives at Omeo, and very later on, in the 1920s, people said, oh no, he was Bogong Jack. So there are two Bogong Jacks. The first Bogong Jack has slightly he's an English gentleman, but not aristocratic. The other guy is very low butcher, but gradually, because there's two folklores, as in happens in folklores, the low-grade Bogong Jack, the second one, takes on the nice aura of the first one. This also happens in the Robin Hood legends in England, by the way. So the public picks out what they want. So you not only have fluid identities of characters themselves, you have this enormous pub folklore which fits all these into convenient archetypes. So it's a real mess. My book was basically to look at all the stories which the novelists had written and say, I don't believe a word of it. I'll try to check everything I can from court records and try to find out the real story as distinct from all the mythic accretions. And as I said, Bogong Jack, who was only named as Bogong Jack in 1968, it's the first naming he gets by old families. He's not in the papers as Bogong Jack at the time. 1968 he's
in
named.
1968.
He's named in 1968. These stories you have to sift out from what you can call factual records, births, trials, other things, to find out what the real story is.
There's a question here. Just stand in front of the microphone.
Patrick, showed us the parallels between New South Wales and Victoria. Free settlers, as you might know, were important here, since that from Brisbane onwards, the main source of revenue to fund the government here was the income from free settlers. Now, I would suggest may be quite a profound difference,
yes,
between the way land was taken up and the way gentlemen were in control and landed New South Wales the highest income in 1870.
Okay, so the suggestion is New South Wales is different because of the influence and significance of free landholders.
That's true. Victoria has what I'd call a telescoped, concertinaed chronology. We get started 50 years after you, so a quarter of Australians' history's gone before we even start up in 1838. And as I said, after it was founded, the first people who came in, they're only the squatters there. The electoral roll of the whole of Gippsland, a third of Victoria, in 1858 is 900 people. Well, they've got wives and kids. There's about 2,000 people there. And they are all squatters and their dependents. No free settlers at all. And when people get into Gippsland and in Victoria, the explorers are the squatters. You don't have a period like Sturt and all these go out and find places and then squatters come in. The explorers are the squatters. In Victoria, these later selectors, who only started in the 1870s, wrote their history. The people who first cut down the trees are the explorers. They're the first selectors, and they wrote their history. So great episodes in Australia, early Australian history, like exploration and other things, don't exist in Gippsland. Or they exist in tiny little windows of opportunity. So it's a very different history than the other colonies.
If I'm correct that having a convict ancestor went from being a cause for stigmatisation to being a mark of prestige, what do you think caused that?
So what caused the movement from being convicts' background being well looked on to... From previously having been poorly looked on.
Yes, well, it's clear the change from the status group I'm talking to the influence of the mateship nationalism, which became the great thing in Australian life. And the Bulletin, of course, and others caused people to... the Bulletin talked about very much the convicts, and they got people interested in that. And it's a romantic thing, just like people thought... Bogong Jack was a romantic figure, although the evidence wasn't there. People gradually thought to be a real Aussie, like Ned Kelly, was to be anti-establishment, to be different, to be socially disadvantaged, whatever it is. That's become now fashionable because respectability... When I grew up in the 1940s, Melbourne was terribly respectable. My parents said to me, whatever you do, think what other people would think of you if you did that. What would other people say? What would other people say if you did that? Respectability was an enormous driver of Australian society when I grew up in the 40s and 50s.
Not in Sydney.
Well, now that the culture came, when the counterculture came, all that went. So even I was affected by this because I found, after looking at records, we're a Victorian family, that one of our ancestors came to Goulburn in the 1840s, Irish, and clearly, although I can't actually prove it, but the people in the New South Wales Registry said he's liable to be a convict because all the Irish in Goulburn in 1840 were very likely to be it. Well, I thought that adds something to the family tree. So, you know, I was affected by that. So I think it's become now... It's the collapse of the respectable Anglo-Australian view that's caused that. And, of course, the other thing has happened, that now they're looking at the records, the old families of squatters of Victoria are finding that they had convict ancestry, which they'd covered up, and everyone knows that there. And that's the joke now, that they got Bass Strait pardons, basically. So it goes both ways. That convict ancestry is held against certain Victorian, like the Armitage, certain very respectable Western District families now have that mentioned, and they don't particularly like it. So it goes a lot of ways.
Question over there, and we'll come here. Yes?
Yes. How did the large influx of people to the goldfields affect the social structure of Victoria?
How did the goldfields inflow affect the social structure of Victoria?
Well... In spite of what I've said, the people who mixed with came from Tasmania mixed with the massive crowd who came from to Australia. The figures are that in the 1850s, close to 500,000 people came to Victoria, 450,000. So you had 150,000 in Melbourne, roughly 150,000 around Ballarat and 150,000 around Bendigo. And apart from the Eureka riot, which is atypical, all the evidence is those three groups, the Tasmanians and the ones who came elsewhere, because there were virtually no people in Victoria when it started, those people actually mixed together very well. There's got terrific goldfields camaraderie in Victoria, so there's no evidence at all that ordinary Tasmanians who get to the goldfields, 10,000 of them, There's no difference between that and people coming from England, because the people coming to Victoria are basically, you would call them lower middle class people without means who are coming to the goldfield. So there's no evidence of social anarchy or disruption. The Eureka thing is an accident and is not typical, because in any society you don't have an armed riot because you disagree with a government decision. In Bendigo, a year before, the licensing blew up, but the commissioner there was sensible and he's worked it out with the diggers and there was no problems. It was just an unfortunate conjunction that the diggers complained, the governor, Hotham, and the army heavied them a bit, but the Eureka heroes, who were supposed to be heroes, were people who said because they disagree with a government, we all disagree with the things government does every day. Jared does. That they actually had an arms erection. So that should not be seen as typical. I'm now apologising to Victorians. We caused the first riot. That in a democracy is a very foolish thing to do and not at all typical of the Victorian goldfields, which have a very good record of prosperity and social cohesion, basically.
So there's a question here, then we go down the back. No, you've had one here. Yeah.
Yeah. My question is, if I understand you correctly, there were some gentlemen from Launceston that went across Bass
Strait. No, I'll repeat it.
And founded Melbourne. But how did they do it? Did they have some help from the British government?
So the question is, how did these gentlemen from Launceston found Melbourne?
Well, first of all, they weren't gentlemen. The gentlemen came in 5 years later. Faulkner and Batman are pretty rough guys who have very shaky records, have no money and are not criminal, but they illegally come to Victoria. They disobey the government, so they're not at all gentlemen. They would be called, one of them had made a bit of money in Launceston, but they're not at all a gentleman group. They are what were just ordinary people of what you'd call free selectors or something like that, who come across disobeying government. They've been told not to move into Victoria for certain reasons. It's not to be opened up. They move in. So they are not the gentlemen. But once it's founded and they notice that there's wonderful plains in the Western districts, the people from England, because there's a very big group, as I said, of army officers and other people who have been displaced from their land, poor, come to Melbourne. It's only a group of 2,000 people who found Melbourne. So the gentlemen come in after and have nothing to do with Batman and Faulkner and the small group of Launceston people who found Melbourne.
Okay, so there's a question down there.
What was the gender balance in the first 50 years or so?
First 50 years of Victoria, what was the gender balance?
Oh, like in all places, it's very much male, to the extent that the first electoral roll, of course, in any of these places only has males, and there's really no... In the squatting place, there's no reason in the very early years for people to come in, and the squatters come in and bring their the explorers come in, and of course bring their families in later. So the gender balance would be very high, and of course the Tasmanians who come across don't bring families with them. The people on the goldfields in Omeo and Ballarat and Bendigo are all basically single males. So there is a very big proportion of males in Victoria. Very soon, immigration comes into Victoria, as I said, because 450,000 people come in a decade. And there's one phenomenon in Victoria that the Irish are the only group who bring in a very large group of women. The figures show 40% of Irish who come are women, because there's nothing for them in Ireland, and they can get positions as governesses. What else do they work as? Governesses,
wives.
Some join the church, but because there's a huge displacement, and of course 50% of marriages in early Victoria are between Catholics and non-Catholics, 50% of these Catholic women who come out in very large numbers married non-Catholics, and they're the only group in Victoria, in early Victoria, who bring in women. basically the other groups who come don't bring in women at that stage. So that makes up for the gender imbalance a bit.
So you're getting very close to, and there's a question there, John, but don't stand in front of the camera. Patrick, come back. Yes. Yes, John, yes.
Look, just an observation. The
quick one.
As an ex-Melburnian, the expatriated members of the Irish Protestant ascendancy had a tremendous influence on the traditions of the Victorian bar, so much so that the court, principal court in Melbourne, is based, modelled on the four courts of Dublin, and also those that take silk at the Victorian bar, where finally word rosette, the back, on the flap. You will, the only place you'll find that anywhere else in the English-speaking world is in Ireland.
So here's a man from Victoria speaking well for the Protestant ascendancy and their influence not only on the court but also on the bar.
Yes, it is true that the among the people who come to Victoria, Protestant Ireland, Irish are disproportionately high, including Rolf Boldrewood, family of Protestant Irish. So there's a very big group, and not only in law, but they are in style. A whole lot of them, early politicians in Victoria, are Protestant Irish. And that, the history shows that that's because at that stage the bar in Ireland, in Dublin, was depressed. There was no work for these people. There's a famous guy whose name is actually Ireland, but he was the leading QC in Melbourne right through this period. He's from the Irish bar. He's involved with the Kelly trials and all those things, but that's true. There's a very big group. And that also goes towards the respectability aspect of Victorian life, because this becomes one of the dominant group who set the tone of Victoria, the Protestant Irish.
Okay, is anyone else? Are we getting... Yes.
I just want to make an observation about the Tasmanian connection. It was very common in those days for the farms in northern Tasmania were not very prosperous and there were great difficulties with lack of communication, whatever. It was very common through the late 19th century for the farmers to go off to the mines in Tasmania to make extra income.
Yeah.
So when there were mines, when there was money to be made in Victoria, that's where they went.
In addition, the Tasmanian farmers moved to Victoria because rural production
Irish.
Was not, and a lot were Irish, because the rural life wasn't very prosperous.
Yes.
Final comment.
I didn't know that, but that's true. Tasmania has a very poor economy, and of course there's no gold, so people are moving to Victoria from Tasmania. And probably still...
They didn't take their families. They would just go away, do the mining job, and then go back.
Yes. A final anecdote. When Catherine Susanna Pritchard, the novelist, was a governess in Port Albert in 1920, a joke there was, because all the people came through Port Albert, was that people would rattle a train down the main street and see who jumped, because they would pick out people. It's probably a bit apocryphal, but that was the joke, because they realised a lot of the wealthy squatters around Port Albert had convict backgrounds. Thank you.
As I said, we've got copies of the Vandemonian Trail. Janet Grundy's got copies. Anne and I at our last night here at 41 Phillip Street after 28 years before we move in the Governor Phillip Tower, as you know. Next week we thought, how could two people from Melbourne end our period at 41 Phillip Street here? And being respectable people, we should invite a respectable Melburnian, Patrick and Anne, along to just tell us what we all missed out here in Sydney without that kind of respectability. And Patrick's given us a fine analysis tonight, not only about the colony of Victoria, but also about the colony of Tasmania and the influence of both of those colonies on the much earlier existing colony in New South Wales. And over many years, Patrick's made an enormous contribution both to national history in Australia, but also, more important, I think, to local history as well, in particular to Gippsland as a part of the local history. So many thanks to Patrick, and we'll see you back in the new building sometime. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.